From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, a San Francisco church opens its doors for homeless people to sleep.
We definitely have gone from an average of like 60 people a day to over 100 people, and that's sleeping at one time.
Then we'll hear how women with paintbrushes change the face of the mission.
So when the Balmy Alley began, it was a good place for the women to start to come out.
And we'll talk with an author about his satirical take on contemporary San Francisco.
This book is a comedy, and the fact that it is a comedy is a liability in terms of the way that people approach it.
We're all over the city today on Cross Currents. For homeless people in San Francisco, finding a safe place to sleep is a problem. At night, it's cold and dangerous. During the day, it's illegal to lie down on the street. The Gubbio Project, a local nonprofit, has a solution: opening up a church's doors so people can sleep on pews during the day. KLW's Angela Johnston spent a morning at St. Boniface Church in the Tenderloin and brings us this story.
Every morning in the Tenderloin, when people all around San Francisco are starting to wake up, around 30 people gather at St. Boniface Church, waiting to go to sleep. When I arrive, I see Josephine Pirouel in the line, bundled up in two hooded sweatshirts, a hat, and mittens.
Like a car runs on fuel. A person won't run without any sleep.
Pirouel has been homeless on and off for a while. A month ago, she says, her boyfriend kicked her out of his place.
I usually used to take casino buses and stay in casinos the whole night and sleep on the casino buses. But my friend brought me here and told me, you can always come here, you know?
From 6 a.m. to 3 p.m., almost every pew in this church and every space on the floor is a place she could sleep. There will be two masses during the day, but no one will ask her to move.
I have not slept maybe this good in like, oh God, over a year.
This arrangement works thanks to the Gubbio Project, a nonprofit that started working with this church 10 years ago. It's named after an Italian village where, legend has it, St. Francis negotiated an agreement between frightened villagers and a hungry wolf, finding common ground. Here at the church, both space and time are shared. As long as the Gubbio Project leaves a few rows of pews open for those who worship, the nonprofit staff can help the homeless with whatever they need to sleep comfortably. At 6 a.m., the church doors open. People file in, dragging their belongings up a metal ramp and along the floor behind them. Suitcases, carts, blankets and clothes in plastic bags. Pirouel finds a spot near the front, puts down her backpack, and stretches out on a wooden pew. She asks program manager Tina Christopher to wake her up at 9 a.m. so she can get to an anger management class downtown. It takes only a few minutes for everyone to settle in. Christopher walks around the aisles, lighting incense and turning on the radiators. She lays out a cardboard box full of blue and white bars of soap and puts a pile of resource pamphlets on top of the church's grand piano. By 6:30, almost every pew is taken. A hush falls over the room, and some people begin to snore.
We definitely have gone from an average of like 60 people a day to over 100 people, and that's sleeping at one time.
Christopher whispers so she won't disturb anyone. She's worked here 5 years and says every year more people come. The confessional booths have been converted into storage cabinets where people can get things like toothpaste, Tylenol, razors, and toilet paper.
Because we just do not have storage space, needing more supplies has definitely happened.
The Gubbio Project started around the same time that then-Mayor Gavin Newsom announced his 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. He said that by 2014, there'd be no more need for emergency shelters, because as soon as a new person arrived on the streets, someone would help them. 10 years and $1.5 billion later, the city says it's moved almost 20,000 homeless people off its streets and into shelters and public housing. But the homeless population hasn't budged. When one homeless person is helped, another immediately takes his or her place. And it's hard for the city to keep up.
I want to get out of the judgment game. They're here because they don't have a house. That's why they're here.
Laura Slattery is head of the Gubbio Project. She says people need a lot of different things, and that's what the group tries to handle.
We're doing a good job of being welcoming, and the streets aren't welcoming. And, you know, we welcome, doesn't matter what people's, you know, sobriety level is at that moment, doesn't matter what their gender identification is, doesn't matter what their sexual orientation is, or their mental health status.
Welcoming everyone brings challenges. Sometimes people yell, scream, and wake others from their sleep. The staff at Gubbio don't do casework, but Slattery says they walk with people, stay with them both mentally and spiritually as they try to calm them down. They physically walk with people, too, around the block to help them cool down or across town to a doctor's appointment. Slattery says it's that daily work that's most valuable.
Every day someone walks in and they live another day, that it's a success story. They didn't die on the streets. They feel welcome. They feel the dignity. You know, that's success.
Around 7 a.m., I meet Joanna Love. She goes by Joy.
It's a good thing to get out of the cold. But I've been coming here because it's a sanctuary. It's like an oasis in the desert.
Love says something about the sacredness of this place and the sacredness of sleep makes people calmer and more relaxed in here.
I've only seen two fights in the 5 years that I've been coming here, and that's a really good thing.
Love also says the church is starting to get crowded. Sometimes, even if she lines up at 5:45 a.m., she won't be able to claim her favorite sleeping spot on the floor near the warm radiator. At 7:30, the church's priest rings the bell for Mass. Some people wake up and stand to pray. For others, the sound means breakfast.
If you don't have a ticket, don't even bother lining up.
Every Friday morning, volunteers come to cook and share food with guests who sleep and rest on the pews. But there are only seats for 50 people, so they pull pew numbers out of a hat.
There you go. Enjoy.
Morning, sir. Meat omelet or veggie omelet?
Meat.
I find Joy Love in the cafeteria with a cup of hot coffee and a fork full of hash browns.
Today they're having hash browns with green onions. They're having omelet with meat, cheese, or vegetables. They have homemade biscuit, coffee, orange juice, a beautiful table. As a matter of fact, I think I'll stop talking. See you later.
After breakfast, the church becomes a bit airier, a bit lighter. People quietly mingle in the back, asking about other city services, figuring out where they can sleep tonight, and getting ready to go back out on the street. Every other week, a nurse podiatrist comes to clean and massage people's feet. The sound of feet getting scrubbed and toenails getting clipped echoes across the room. At 2:40 in the afternoon, Tina Christopher and the volunteers begin to wake everyone up. Slowly, people open their eyes. They stretch, yawn, gather their things into plastic bags and suitcases, dragging them behind as they make their way out of the church. I catch Joy Love on her way out the door and ask her where she's headed.
Down to Golden Gate.
She doesn't know where she'll go at night, she says, but she'll be back here again tomorrow morning at 5:45, ready to sleep. In San Francisco, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in March 2015. In December, the Gubbio Project opened a second site at St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church in San Francisco's Mission District. Find out how you can get involved at kalw.org and click Cross Currents. Thank you. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. The Mission District is famous for its vibrantly colored murals, and some of its oldest murals can be found in Balmy Alley. Mia Gonzalez started the mural project in the early 70s when the alley was a rundown little street that connected 24th Street with nearby Presida Park. She wanted to make the alley safer for the kids who were walking through on their way to the park. What she didn't expect was that it would launch a new wave of women muralists working in a strong Chicana tradition. Gonzalez sat down in the StoryCorps booth with art archivist Linda Wilson.
I remember in Balmy Alley, when we started the Balmy Alley Mural Project in 1971, I think it was, and the houses, they were so dilapidated. I mean, they were just falling apart. That's why we did it. The fences were falling, but so we decided to make that sort of a safe haven for the kids to come back and forth over. I wrote up a letter to go to all the houses around on 24th Street, which were very few, the houses within Balmy Alley on both sides, and then on Shotwell. And we asked to see if it was okay to paint their fences. They thought it was a gimmick. We said, no, it wasn't. And then, oddly enough, we were so naive, we had no idea that many of those people were not homeowners themselves, and any homeowner that was there lived outside of San Francisco. And then there were families that were living in multiple units that were afraid then, this is the early 70s, that we were part of the migra. So I said, no, we just want to know about the landlord and, you know, get permission to paint the fence. So that's how we did it.
Well, Balmy Alley is internationally known now of a major mural project on a street, and it was a place where it really sort of united young artists at the time, because we were all young at that time, to paint, to do murals, and it was an opportunity where the women were actually given a format of expression. Because the muralist movement, I would say, probably began in the early 70s, and it was predominantly male-oriented. And they kind of kept it as a tight under their hands. And then when the women... So when the Balmy Alley began, it was a good place for the women to start to come out. There's only one mural from that original group that still exists. Mm-hmm. And that's with Irene Perez on the very last double doors with two little, like, children, elves or something, mm-hmm. playing a flute. Mm-hmm. And that's the last of that original mural project.
Those were the voices of Mia Gonzalez and Linda Wilson. Their conversation was recorded in the StoryCorps booth in San Francisco. And if you know someone with a great story who you'd like to interview, you can do that with San Francisco StoryCorps, and maybe your story will end up on Cross Currents. Go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents to find out how. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In Toni Tuulatimuuti's debut novel, Private Citizens, a group of four recent Stanford graduates are living in San Francisco. They're trying to navigate the worlds of tech, nonprofits, identity, and, of course, love. It's satire, and it's wince-worthy in its accuracy. KALW's Nina Gensler-Deb sat down with Tuulatimuuti to learn about how his own time in the Bay Area influenced the book and why he chose to make it a comedy.
I want to be careful to distinguish that this is fiction and it's not only informed by your own life or even mostly informed. But, you know, you did go to Stanford and you are Thai and you worked in the tech world. So I'd love to hear about, A, how this informed the book that you wrote and also what you tried to reserve for yourself.
There's one character that I think people are going to associate me with right off the bat, which is a character named Will. Will is a Thai American web developer who is biographically very similar to me. He's from Massachusetts. He lived in Noe Valley, which I did. And it was because I was aware that on the basis of race alone, people were going to be identifying me with him. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people, especially mass media, television, movies, stuff like that, in order to try to do an end run around stereotypes, they try to just take everything and flip it 180 degrees and say, like, well, we're going to make this Asian guy, you know, 8 feet tall and a woman, like a lady killer or something, you know. And, you know, to me, there's just something really fake and demeaning about that. What I tried to do instead was something that writers like Juno Diaz and Philip Roth and Mary Gateskill have done before, which is try to preserve the stereotype, actually, and even exaggerate it to a sort of absurd degree. But also write the character deeply enough that it becomes clear that no matter how well somebody fits a stereotype, there's so much to them beyond that, that they can be identified as an individual, that the stereotypical aspects of them are actually the least important.
Will is obviously not the only character. There are four main characters, and all of them are in certain ways more extreme versions of different kinds of stereotypes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I felt like they all were marked by such self-loathing and just struggling with that. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about inhabiting all of those different characters who are very different in a number of ways, but all seem to be struggling with that at times comic and at times really, really sad, yeah, self-loathing.
And, yeah. I'm really glad you identified it as self-loathing because, you know, less charitable reviewers and workshoppers have read the book and said things like, why does the author think he's so much better than these characters, you know? I think early on I had a bigger problem with this when I didn't get the voice quite right. You hear these characters basically haranguing themselves constantly. But self-loathing is a really important part. You could actually say that it's a sort of common meeting ground between these four very different characters. And a lot of where that comes from is privilege, right? Privilege is something that you can't really opt out of. You don't really have a say in whether or not you have it or not, much like other sort of identity things like race. Why does it give rise to self-loathing? It's because when you are aware, painfully aware, that you have you are the beneficiary of these different kinds of privilege, and you still fail to achieve your goals, you know, it's easy to sort of turn this inward and say, I'm benefiting from an unfair system and I'm still f***ing up. And here, you know, I wanted to show how privilege can actually maim someone, you know, do them real physical and psychic harm.
I am speaking with Toni Tuulatimuuti about Private Citizens, which is a book that takes place here in San Francisco. But, oh, God, it's 2016. I was about to say it's 7 years in the past, but it's not. It's
no.
9 years ago, which is crazy. And so I'm going to have you do the reading, if you would, that part. Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, so here it's a section about the character Linda. Linda is this very young, precocious 21-year-old who's skipped a bunch of grades, and she's what we would identify as like a hipster, right? She's really severely judgmental, and she doesn't really have a fixed address. She's been getting by exploiting friends and guys that she's dating for places to stay. And she prides herself on this sort of identity that she's like forged because she also believes in herself as a writer. The problem is that she doesn't really do any writing. So So here she's showing up to a party, and the idea is that she's trying to look for someone new to stay with because she's kind of worn out her welcome at this other place. So she's wandering around a party right now. Linda took a pint bottle of wild turkey from the bar and nursed it in the hallway until two guys approached her. They looked identical, beards and knit caps and red plaid flannels. She really couldn't tell the difference between them. She missed the beginning of what one of them was saying. But then how do you explain all the identifiable stereotypes, right? Like, what are skinny jeans but the millennial beret? Or like the overgroomed beard, a perfect emblem of masculine ambivalence emerging from a progressive subculture rooted in regressive nostalgia and pride mingled with shame, not to mention sincere aestheticism performed through ironic mediums, who love good coffee but complain about what good coffee places do to their neighborhoods, and who will collect vinyl from the 90s but sneer at the bands they followed 3 years ago whose breakout success they themselves enabled, hold art openings in vintage clothes stores, music shows and car washes, bars and converted barber shops, and an again ironic expression of the sincere impulse to live the bohemian lifestyle while evoking the authentic vocational self-sufficiency of the parents who bankroll their freewheeling endeavors. Linda was stunned by the ecstatic tsunami of irritation massing and cresting inside her as she listened to this tedious, pukesome conversation. She glanced from idiot to idiot as if observing a ping-pong match between players who missed the table every time.
God, talk to me about writing that passage.
So the passage was originally two paragraphs long, and I was taking a workshop with Wells Tower at Iowa, and he never really writes on manuscripts.
Just to clarify quickly for people, you're speaking of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop.
That's right, yeah. And he read this passage. And next to this passage, she wrote tedious and pukesome, which is a phrase that I ended up co-opting for the passage, right? But I don't know. My process is like 80% spite-driven. So when I read this, I'm just like, oh, then I just need to make it 8 times longer. I need to put hyphens between every single word. And I need to exacerbate everything that I take to understand that he found objectionable about the passage. Stylistically and aesthetically, and also on a plot level, I wanted to not shy away or make the subjects I'm writing about artificially demure. I really wanted to go like over the top with them. This book is a comedy, and the fact that it is a comedy is a liability in terms of the way that people approach it, because people have a lot of assumptions about comedies that they're basically less inherently important or interesting than drama. It's sort of, you know, the proverbial like redheaded stepchild of drama, right? But it's never that need of a division. There are very few books that are totally devoid of, there are very few comedies that are devoid of tragedy and vice versa, right? So I just see it as an artificial distinction. It's a cliche to say something is it's funny because it's true, but you know the salient point there is that things are really really funny because you recognize them to be true, but just in a way that you've never expected or a perspective you never considered before, and you know that to me is as good a criterion for literary fiction as any.
That was author Tony Tulatamuti speaking with KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs about his book Private Citizens. You can find Private Citizens at your local bookstore. And while you're at the bookstore, you can also pull out your phone and hear some more Cross Currents on iTunes. Then tell us what you think at news@kalw.org. Our team includes Lisa Bartfy, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Troop Nguyen, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Hey, woman, where'd we go wrong?
Today's local music is by Oakland's fantastic Negrito. Last year, he won NPR's Tiny Desk Concert Contest, but he'll have a larger stage to perform this Friday when he appears at the Bottle Rocket Music Festival in Napa. All the details are at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Tell me all your worries, 'cause I don't want you to go.